House Finance come to order. It's 9:19 a.m. on the 20th of March, 2012. Members present, Representative Newman, Representative Costello, Representative Edgman, Co-Chair Thomas, Stoltz, Representative Guerra, T. Wilson, and Guttenberg. And Representative Dugan, as staff has told me, he's ill today. Good wishes for him to be back amongst us again soon.
Missing the donuts.
And I bought donuts just gratuitously for something like that. So help yourselves to those. We have three bills that we're going to attempt to get through today: House Bill 261, House Bill 196, and then House Bill 9, which there will not be, we won't be passing out House Bill 9 for anybody. There's still substantial work to do on that one. There's proposed amendments. It's our intent that that we'll have a brief discussion of the amendments, and I want the public to see those, and I'm sure like those to be at the LIO offices as well. It's a little premature in the process. We haven't heard the public testimony to start taking amendments, but we've had evolving CSs, so we'd like to have the public to look at be able to see the process. So that's the intent on that. And just let the committee know we're scrambling to try to find some time for in the evenings for public testimony on this one, which would probably be more conducive to the public anyway. So maybe we'll know by the end of this meeting, when I get a chance to sit down in my office, but very potentially Wednesday and Thursday nights this week to hear from the public on this bill. So times to be announced very quickly, and we'll do that in addition to letting the clerk know what's been previously heard. But we want to make sure the public knows. We'll probably put out a release on that as well, which is a little atypical for this committee. But we will endeavor to let the public know their opportunities. Wish I had more days in advance, but that's where we're at. We have 261 and 196. I'd like to invite whichever way you'd like to present it for you to come before us, Representative Edgman. And certainly invite anybody you want to assist you. I know you know how to walk this dog when you come to commercial fishing.
Haven't we passed this bill like three times?
That's just, we have this amendment for charter and personal use purposes, but to design new dip nets, I think. We have a committee substitute before us. Mr. Co-Chair, can you move that for discussion purposes?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move for adoption CS, House Bill number 261, Finance, version 27, LS0968/B, Bullard, 31912 as a working document.
I'm going to object just so our committee staff can briefly go over the changes they've worked on with Representative Bryce, Edgman's staff. Representative Bryce, Edgman's staff, not the former Representative Bryce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Michelle, House Finance staff. The CS before you is very much this. There were just three things removed from the bill. There was nothing added to the bill. From the previous version, Section 1, Section 4 were removed. And in Section 5, Paragraph B was removed. This had to do with removing the 2% below the prime rate aspect of the bill. It was removing competing with other banks and just focusing on raising the level. The things that were left in were focusing on raising the level of the loan being able to be made, but the percentages and some of those things were just removed for nothing was added.
That was in concurrence with the sponsor.
Through the chairman, yes, sir.
I'll remove my objection. Are there any other objections to? Hearing none, the CS is before us, and that was as noted by the co-chair. Thank you, Mr. Michelle.
Good morning, Chairman Stoltz. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 37, which is Southwest Alaska. I want to thank you and the committee for hearing House Bill 261 this morning. And And this bill deals with the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund Act, a program that's been around to assist commercial fishermen basically since the 1980s. And for those of you who've been around the process for a number of years, you've seen a number of iterations of this program, a number of bills coming forward to either add or modify or change the terms of the existing loan programs or the various sections. Right now in the commercial fishing loan program, there's six different sections. And what we're trying to do with House Bill 261 is go to Section B and to just basically raise the limit from $100,000 to $200,000. And the purpose of doing that is to allow economically disadvantaged fishermen to be able to keep up with the times, if you will, take advantage of this particular loan section, to be able to buy limited entry permits that are rising in value, as everything else is, it seems, across the board. So House Bill 261 would again increase the Section B loan limit from $100,000 to $200,000. And the original bill, Mr. Chairman, actually tried to do a little bit more than that. It would have taken that Section B provision and given the financing section of the Division of Economic Development the opportunity to provide lower than the prime interest rate loan by two points. So the original bill would have provided for interest rates 2% below the current 5.25. Well, after conversations with the department and looking at the longer-term picture, interest rates, of course, probably will go up at some point. It was felt that maybe that was too ambitious of an agenda. So we scaled the bill that's before you now back to just that one provision of increasing the limit from $100,000 to $200,000. Mr. Chairman, you know, you look at the limited entry permits these days. Southeast Saying is going for about $130,000. Prince William Sound Driftnet, $160,000. Alaska Peninsula Drift Gillnet is $130,000. Bristol Bay Drift Gillnet fluctuates every year, the one I'm most familiar with. That's about $150,000. Now, in order to be eligible for a Section B loan, you have to first be turned down by a couple of conventional lending institutes or CFAB. You also have to show that you're economically disadvantaged, that you've been a fisherman for 2 years, and so it's a pretty strict requirement to get into this loan program at all. We're expecting the demand for the program to be not as if we're opening up the floodgates. But
what does CFAB do anymore? I know the only thing I hear from them is they want to get a farmer off their board. And so they still want to have agriculture in there. And I hear repeatedly that, well, when we can't get it from CFAB, Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, they want to remove the farmer, and I hear repetitive problems about they don't loan to fishermen. Am I just hearing anecdotes that are unrepresentative, or what's a?
I'm not sure. I would just say this: I don't know if Leah Klingert is online or not, or if she's going to be testifying today. But that
I don't want to bring up getting my farmer out there. of the agricultural bank, but that's another story. But I hear repeatedly, well, when we get turned down by CFAB and we have to go to a conventional bank, and I mean, you represent a fishing district, and presumably access or trying to access. Any idea about that entity?
I'm not sure, but boy, this is the perfect segue for me to talk about maybe the loan demand of this bill. If there were any concerns by CFAB or any other sort of banks that this would be taking business away from them, we would argue otherwise, in that, again, to get through all the hurdles it takes to qualify for the
business system, that they're not taking.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. All right, please, go ahead. Segue as you will. I represent an ag district. I don't know a lot about commercial fishing.
And actually, we have a few commercial fishermen who are up in the ag district as well. There's quite a number who, particularly in the Bristol Bay area.
I hear from all 8 or 10 of them. I'm just teasing. Go ahead. But anyway, I think I strayed.
Anyway, getting back to the projected demand, I think the department will probably maybe have some more detailed testimony that actually what the demand for this program, assuming the bill gets through and signed by the governor. But we think the demand is going to be, anywhere from, pick a number, maybe 25, maybe 50 on the high end, if at all. We had about 50 young fishermen come down to Juneau about a month ago in the Young Fishermen Summit and heard a great amount of enthusiasm for taking the Section B loan limit and raising it from 100,000 to 200,000 so that these young fishermen have another vehicle to get into the commercial fishing business. So, again, we're not looking at, 1,000 people coming forward. I don't think there's going to be that many people that could actually qualify for the Section B provisions, but those fishermen that will help, and we expect that it will primarily be younger fishermen who don't have the, financial wherewithal at this point starting out to apply with a normal bank or to get through the other loan sections. So we think the demand is going to be pretty modest, at least starting out, but still significant in the sense that if it helps 15, 20 young Alaskans get into the fishery, that the economic development the multiplier effect from that is pretty powerful, and especially for the smaller communities along the coastline.
And just I would say, for the record, I have substantially more commercial fishermen. Because there are actually a lot of them are my pretty good friends, surprisingly. But anyway, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just to speak to the fiscal note, if I could, for a second. The fiscal note in front of you, and it should be... It's the latest one at the very bottom. It should say 3/20/12, 8:50 p.m. But it should read zero throughout the number section of the fiscal note. And if you turn the page, the narrative is somewhat incorrect. And I want to address that and then maybe sort of set the stage for the department to speak in more detail about that. But the narrative speaks about the interest rate provisions for these loans in sentence two. Would be set at prime minus 2 points or 3% in current terms, and that's incorrect. I think that's pretty obvious that refers to the previous iteration of the bill, and again, the department can come up and
we will have them come up when we get to our fiscal note discussion.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think that's the bill in its entirety, and it's certainly be available for any questions. My staff is here in the room, and we've got... gentleman from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, as well as others who'd be willing to talk more to the bill itself.
Yeah, and we have one member from the general public and a couple of people from the administration. They say they only want to respond to questions, but I think I want to bring them up and maybe get over their reticence or shyness. They may be prompted by questions to be more, to have a dialogue, as I think. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Appropriate to ask a question now.
Right, fire away.
This is not something that a business that I'm familiar with, so I look for you for guidance. But my question is, are we, by increasing the limit, are we, and having young people come into the business, buy into the business with a loan or a permit, are we putting them underwater? I mean, as far as the weight of a loan on their shoulders.
Is this a fishing joke underwater?
No, it's a real question. It's not a baseball analogy, but
take a swing at that one.
That is actually a great question to talk a little bit more about how it's getting more expensive to get into various fisheries. As Representative Thomas knows better than any of us, back when he got in the fisheries, he's explained to the committee before, vis-a-vis where we're at today, the cost of everything from the boat to the nets to insurance to food to fuel to and finally to limited entry permits, which we're talking about today, really have all just gone up considerably. But our thrust with this bill is if we can get young fishermen to get that limited entry permit, their license to actually go out and harvest, they have a much better opportunity to get all those other pieces to get out on the water and become commercial fishermen. So I guess the short answer would be we think that this would really be a, I'm not going to say it's going to be a direct pathway for all aspiring fishermen, but it'll certainly be opening up maybe the major door for them to get involved in the commercial fisheries.
Hello, Representative Guttenberg.
I'm just looking for the analogy that makes it. No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, you keep chumming the waters. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many have defaulted on these types of loans?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I'm going to defer to the department in terms of specific numbers, but historically the rate has been really low. And the loan portfolio itself has performed very admirably. It's somewhere, I think, the principal is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $80 million. And sort of like other quasi-state agencies that have returned money to the state general fund, like the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, or ADA, so has this loan fund done the same as well. It's actually returned excess funds to the Department of Fish and Game, and so the short version would be that the default rate has been very, very low.
Thank you.
So is it a true revolving fund that is well securitized? And
yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
And then, like, Representative Costello Langara.
Thank you, through the Chair, Representative Edgman. I was just curious if you have information on the cost of the permits over time since the program was started. I'd be curious to see those figures.
Through the Chair, Costello. The trend lines do show that permit prices obviously gyrate in some cases pretty wildly. It's tied to the market prices for the particular products. In this instance, we're largely talking about, or even exclusively talking about salmon permits. So if you look at the trend lines over time, the permit prices have, the correlation has been pretty close to the actual ex-vessel price of salmon themselves. I'll take Bristol Bay, for example. Back in early 2000, when the ex-vessel price was 40 cents a pound or so, in that real low range for sockeye salmon, the price of limited entry permits plummeted down to, at one point, it was $18,000. Now that the ex-vessel price is north of a dollar a pound for sockeye, which is the primary fish out in Bristol Bay, we're looking at permit prices that have gone from $18,000 up to $150,000. And like Representative Thomas was just motioning a second ago, as well as Co-Chair Stoltz, the trend lines do go up and down like this considerably. So sometimes the prices can be, permits can dip down dramatically. Other times they rise up dramatically as well.
One follow-up question, final question. Do you know the average age of a commercial fisherman in Alaska?
Through the Chair, Representative Costello, our focus has been on the average age of limited entry permit holders, and that number has just been creeping upwards. It's somewhere within the range of 50 years old now. And if you take all the various fisheries and average them out, it's 48 years, I think, as the mean in Bristol Bay, the Alaska Peninsula, is 53 years.
We used to think that was old, right, Bruce?
50 years young, Mr. But you know, it's like a lot of, through the Chair, Representative Costello, it's like a lot of our other workforce sectors. This term graying of the fleet may be most commonly applied to the fishing industry. But there's really a graying of a fleet in a lot of our workforce areas in the state of Alaska. And, today we're talking about commercial fishing, but really when you look at the other sectors, that phenomenon is occurring as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there an Alaska residency requirement to qualify for these loans, as some there is?
Through the Chair, Representative Garrett, absolutely. In fact, you have to be a fisherman for two out of the last 5 years in order to qualify for the loan program. You have to clearly establish your residency. I believe, and I'll have the department correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's through the permanent fund criteria.
And just one other follow-up, Mr. Chair. I know originally you wanted some sort of lower loan rate, and then the bill has changed, but is there a loan rate that wouldn't cost the department money that would let them stay even, that we could put into the bill? I suppose the goal is to not establish a loan rate that would cause them to bleed money, but the loans have generally been paid back. It seems to be a solvent program. So do you know if there's a loan rate that we can establish in the bill that would hold the department harmless and let the loan fund go ahead unharmed?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, if I could, I want to backtrack just a second because I'm looking at my notes. I think I slightly misspoke a minute ago. In terms of residency, it says here that you have to be a state resident for a continuous period of 2 years immediately preceding the date of application. So I just wanted to correct that. Regarding the interest rate provision, the way the program, commercial fishing loan program, is structured in statute is that it's 2 points above prime. Today, prime is somewhere within the neighborhood of 3.25. So under this bill, House Bill 261, the loan applicants would come in at 5.25. If they pay on time, there's a provision that allows for the interest rate to go down a point. So you get in the program, you prove up for that first year that you're in the program, you can take that 5.25 interest rate number and bring it down to 4.25. But you're still a point above where prime is. And so that moves up as interest rates, of course, in the market fluctuate.
Thanks.
And these, again, are securitized loans, just not a signature loan.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edgman, on the interest rate, is there other interest rates specified in statute as to how these loans are regulated, or is... I've got a couple other questions that kind of go towards that.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, my recollection from the enabling statutes are that the loan rate tied to the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Act is tied specifically to the prime rate. I think that's just basically it.
And so the board that oversees the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund, they don't have any say as to what the interest rates are?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. Well,
or is it just held statutorily?
I don't want to get off subject here, but that takes us back to the original intent of this legislation, which was to enable the financing section, the old division of investments as we knew it for all those years, to be able to provide these Section B recipients with the ability to actually go 2% under prime, which they can do by way of regulation. Now, that provision is taken out of the bill. It's 2% above prime by statute. So I would reply to your answer, your question, by saying that that the rules are pretty well laid out in statute. It's what's considered, you know, just the general prime rate. And 2 points above that in order for someone to participate in the Section B loan provision.
Mr. Chair, what I was trying to get at is, do we have, Representative Edgman, do we have different interest loan rates for different fishermen under this program? It seems like what I'm hearing is we have different rates of interest on different loans, all underneath the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund. Because, I don't know, we keep looking at it different ways, but it seems like different fishermen are paying different amounts of interest.
Is that when the loan originated and what the interest rate was, or is there another factor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I'm quickly getting out of my level of expertise here because there's six different sections. There are a couple of provisions. And you may remember a couple of years ago we passed.
I'd like to maybe invite Mr. Trombley up here just so he can augment this.
Actually, somebody from the Department of Commerce.
Well, when it airs, okay. Thank you for directing traffic there, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm in different waters than I'm usually in.
Well, she's coming up here, if I may, just to respond to Representative Newman's question.
Come on and join us.
A couple years ago, we did pass a bill, House Bill 20, that enabled us to take advantage of going 2 points below prime.
Those are the energy efficiency loans, right?
Exactly. That's for fishermen to buy energy-efficient engines and generators, sets for their boats. That's a pretty conscripted piece of legislation that did get passed and signed into law. That's one example.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony in those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Winnetta Ayers. I'm with the Division of Economic Development. I'm the director. And to respond to the specific question from Representative Newman, it is true that in statute, with regard to the eligible purposes under the Commercial Fishing Loan Revolving Loan Fund, that there are different interest rates set for different purposes. We cannot, through our senior loan committee, consider different interest rates other than what's in statute. But it is true over time, depending on where prime is, that borrowers may be paying different interest rates under the fund.
Mr. Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to get some clarification. It seems like we've set up, because we've looked at this issue several different times, we've got different interest rates now for these fishermen, and I would think that they would have to try and find which each works financially they could work within themselves, I guess, in the board to try and figure that out to get the best interest rates for what they're working on. But we have several rates set now because we've looked at this statutorily instead of allowing the board to decide or set interest rates.
Can these things be refinanced through a process, or are they locked in?
Mr. Chairman, the interest rates are fixed for the term of the loan. There is a refinancing option, and certainly borrowers consider that with regard to their loans when it is feasible, just as any borrower would for any kind of loan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions while we have Ms. Ayers up here?
Just a comment.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, why don't we roll this into the student loan forgiveness thing if we're concerned about occupations? I mean, if we're doing it for teachers, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, why not the fishermen? The fishing industry seems to me that we were just giggling about a little while ago. You know, we want to help everybody else. If we have a grain of the fleet, maybe we should help them. But it's just a comment. I know that people should think about that. Why do we pick one occupation and we identify that we have a grain of the fleet here? So the other comment, Representative, the 200,000, why did you pick that number? I know permits are as high as 400 in some parts of the state.
Through the Chair, Representative Thomas, we thought that was a number that would address the majority of the salmon fisheries around the coast. I mean, you're right. We, you know, arguably you could raise it to $300,000 or $400,000, but at the same time we were concerned about not only the demand level, but what it might do to the fund as a whole if you did raise it to $400,000, keeping an eye out that interest rates now are so low that over the future, when you look at a 15-year amortization schedule, that those interest rates could, over time, increase. So you have the portfolio itself earning at one rate, and you have all these low interest rates, maybe up to $400,000. So we settled on the number of 200,000 as being the number that seemed to accommodate the most number of fishermen at this point.
It's doubling it from 100K to 200K. Mm-hmm. Any other questions while Ms. Ayers is up there? You're free to flee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
While you're here, Mr. Trombley, why don't you come up and just see if there's any questions? You can perhaps flee quickly, too. But I suspect if you come up here, there'll be a few questions. And just please give us your general comments on the legislation and how your commission, your quasi-judicial agency, I believe, is interfaced with this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bruce Twomley, Chairman of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. I want to mention I'm here with my co-commissioner, Judge Peter Freilich, as well. But listening to the discussion, I wanted to mention that in terms of a fear that fishermen will put themselves underwater through this program, we have monitored the price of permits for a long time. In the program of 1980 through 2011, and permits reflect the special market for permits, and they reflect what fishermen are willing to invest in the fishery and their expected returns from the fishery. It's individual fishermen putting their money at risk in order to participate and get the permit as a ticket to participate in the fishery. And for our purposes, that's really one of the the best measures of what a fishery will bear, what people in the real world are willing to put at risk, and what their expectations are for return from the fishery. Now, with respect to Bristol Bay permits and Bristol Bay drift permits in particular, Bristol Bay is the largest salmon fishery, as you know. In the 32 years that we have been following permit prices, looking at Bristol Bay drift gillnet permits, out of those 32 years, in 16 of them, the average and the median for Bristol Bay drift gillnet permits has exceeded $100,000. And that's true currently. So that I think that the $200,000 range provided by this bill is a good ballpark. I think I think it will cover the cases we were concerned about. And I guess we always viewed it as somewhat ironic. I remember years ago, Nels Anderson established this program to give particularly rural people access to credit they might not otherwise be able to obtain. And it was ironic in the largest fishery that the permits very quickly exceeded the ceiling for the Section B loans. And we are really pleased that Representative Edgeman has provided this potential fix for that problem. I think this could be a very helpful supplement to some things that are going on the grounds out in Bristol Bay and elsewhere around the state. And also, this is one, it's a concrete response to the House Concurrent Resolution 18. This is something to point to, I think, that's responsive to the issues raised by that resolution. So we think this is a great idea.
I know what happens to a house when if you take out a loan for a couple hundred grand and it's you find it's only worth 60 grand. A lot of times we believe the keys. What happens to a permit? Are there any different legal statuses on a limited entry permit? And how is it disposed of in collections and so forth? Can you put any of that on the record?
Well, I only watch this from the distance of our agency. But I know that the state loan program has been very responsive, and they haven't been quick on the trigger when it comes to foreclosure, and they've had a tremendous success rate in maintaining the loans. If it comes to a foreclosure, they're obligated to sell the permits in a commercially reasonable manner, but there are procedural protections for the fishermen in their statutes, and we've seen the process go forward, and we've seen lots of fishermen helped by the program. We haven't seen fishermen hurt by the program, and I think very few have been subject to foreclosure. But I have to defer to one of the heirs to give you more detail.
There's an enhanced protection for the borrower that another debtor might not have?
I think that's true, yes, by statute.
I'd heard that anecdotally, but I didn't, I don't, probably it's, if I'm the only one who had a curiosity, it's not worth fleshing out, but it's, apparently, things are going okay. Representative Thomas.
Thank you. I've been on their list of permits, trying to buy permits for my kids, and when they have a repo permit, you can bid on them if you're the highest bidder. But I've been on Bristol Bay permits when they were like 60,000, and the two were up, and they went for 90. And I don't think I defaulted or what later, because I see them standing in Southeast too now, but you can bid on them when they have the recode. You go in and you get on the web page and work that way. So,
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Edgeman, I, in reviewing the packet, I saw one letter of opposition and I saw a rebuttal in it from you. Has that letter changed since you defined or pointed to the amendment that happened in the previous committee, or do we have an update, or is that particular group still in opposition?
Can you, through the chair, Representative Fairclough?
It's a debtor letter dated January 25th, 2012. It's from the Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank. I didn't want to put anyone's name on the record if they changed their opinion or
Yeah, that letter from CFAB, again through the chair, Representative Fairclough, was addressing the earlier version of the bill. And now that we've reduced it down to just this one element of doubling the limit of the bill, we have not heard from CFAB, at least formally, on the bill. So I'm not going to speak for CFAB, but they certainly had a concern with going down to that lower interest rate. Now that we're just raising the ceiling, we have not heard from them specifically.
They know the committee schedule, so they know how to get here if they had a concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Twombly.
Thank you.
Mr.
Kirk, can I just ask
one
stupid question?
Why break the dunk on? Except Gary, yes, go ahead. You set me up, I'm sorry.
So obviously somebody got the commercial fisheries entry permits and they get sold at market value, which isn't something that sits all that well with me, that people get to make a ton of money out of public resource. And in subsequent permit programs, have we changed that rule? Or have there been subsequent permit programs? It seems to me once you stop fishing, you should have to turn the permit back in.
That's a no. This provision for free transferability has persisted throughout the program, and actually, I mean, we found it useful because in balance, it's a way to help Alaskans get and keep limited entry permits. If you actually have a program where these things reverted to the state, and you're going to have to reissue them in some fashion, I mean, that's a process that would be open to the whole world. And we see that in some of the council programs. As it is, this gives Alaskans a fair shot at it, Alaskans who are partners and family members and neighbors of permit holders. And if you look at transferability over time, in terms of Alaskan versus non-Alaskan permit holding, excuse me, there's actually a net gain to Alaskans from transfers of permits, something like a net gain of 200 permits over all the years of the program have come back to Alaskans over and above the permits that have been sold outside.
May I ask a smart question?
Yeah, Representative Garrett.
How is it that, if you could help me, it's actually just as dumb as the last one. How is it that the current system keeps the permits more easily within the Alaska community?
It creates the opportunity for that to occur. One of the problems in Alaska is that because of provisions of Article 8, you can't really direct the permits where you might want them to go. I mean, everybody can see communities in need and think, wouldn't it be nice for them to have more permits? But Alaska can't really create a program that does that because of constitutional prohibitions. But because of transferability, you create the opportunity for that to happen. And in Bristol Bay in particular, there's some really good things going on the ground. Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation has its own regional permit brokerage there. They've got their own loan guarantee program, which is an opportunity to bring forward a good candidate for loans and make sure they're capable of taking on the loans and the responsibilities. And through the loan guarantee program in particular, you can influence where these permits go, and that's where the opportunity is created.
Thank you. If this involves sport fishing, I'd understand it a lot better, but I appreciate the information.
I do have a question for Mr. Cromley. The Constitution, when our framers had no exclusive rights of fisheries, and then the Constitutional Amendment in 72, as I was just refreshing it, allowed it to for conservation and for prevent economic distress. That's not a mandate in our Constitution. That allows a statutory framework, doesn't it? That it doesn't mandate that we do create exclusive fisheries, but it did allow it, and the same statute that created the limited entry law could be amended. Is that an incorrect reading?
No, it could be, but when the state has tried to direct benefits. I mean, a good example is subsistence, where our own Supreme Court struck down a rural preference for subsistence in times of scarcity. That didn't stand up to constitutional scrutiny. And there have also been some local hire attempts to direct modest attempts to direct local hire into rural villages, and those have been struck down under some under the equal protection clauses of the Constitution. So, I mean, prospects aren't good for a program that would directly try to give resource entitlements to particular communities or particular people.
I don't think you answered the question, but probably not going to get very far. So,
yep.
It's really not as relevant to the bill, but I don't think it's accurate on the record that that's a constitutional right that's been embedded. It was a, I think it was an allowance, and to allow the statutory framework. And I think it's by you and others to say that it's an inherent constitutional right now that there's an exclusive right is an error on the record.
Well, Mr. Chair, I may have misspoken. I may not have understood the question. I mean, of course the statute can be recommended, and it's not a right, it's a privilege, and the legislature reserved the right to modify it.
Yeah, I just wanted that clear. I'm not proposing that, but I think it's often too, it's trumpeted by the mine industry. We have an exclusive right. No, the Constitution allows a deviation from that right established during the Constitutional Convention ratified, but it's not a guarantee, and it could be changed by statute, probably not without a bloodbath, both in the courts and public opinion. I don't want to be, but I think it's, and I did hear a little bit of almost an echoing of that when you said it was a constitutional right, and I'm glad you amended your statement. But and this is one of those things where Representative Garamite and I have a little simpatico going, but I think, but again, I don't have any illusions that anything amending the limited entry statute would get very far in the political process, maybe by initiative, which would be appropriate, but certainly not in the state. But I'm going to throw enough gas on the fire in this little weenie roast, Mr. Co-Chair.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. I have told the commercial fishermen the little card that we get each year is a privilege from the state to fish and harvest the resource, not to block other industries from developing. They come out, and I've gone to public testimonies about mining permits. I'm a limited entry permit holder. You'll destroy my fishery. Well, let the process go through first. That privilege was given to us by the people of the state, and I firmly believe it wasn't used to lay in front of the cat to protest and object to things. And somehow people believe it's theirs exclusively. And I tell them, you know, beware. One of these days an initiative will come because you're blocking development and you're not allowing the people in the rest of the room the privilege to work. They give us the privilege to work by buying these permits. Don't go out there and mess it up by, you know, stopping your neighbors from working. Not everybody can, as you can see, can afford to buy a permit. That was grandfathered mine. That's why, you know, kind of springboard from there. But, yeah, I get real heartburn when people say, I have this permit, let's shut down this industry or that industry. Well, and just to clarify for Representative Guerra, we pay around 7% of our gross of our income for raw fish tax, enhancement tax, and a marketing fee. So, you know, and it varies in different areas. If you have a marketing group, like in Bristol Bay, I believe it's 2%, so it can go as high. And we totally support the Commercial Fishery Entry Commission by the permits that we buy and actually generate a surplus. But we have limited entry permits and vessel licenses that we buy through them. We try to be self-sustaining. How's that?
Well, that upbeat note, we're going to get back to that. I'm sorry, I detoured this.
Yeah, furthermore.
So, thank you very much, Mr. Cromley. And we had one person set to testify, Mr. McCune. Well, you can stay up here, Bryce. Representative Edgman.
Probably out of ways to filibuster your bill at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska, and we support this bill. I think it would give Alaskans an opportunity to gather up some of these permits that people that qualify for these loans. I think there's five loans now over 100,000 and some fast approaching that. So there's only three ways to buy a permit. You can go to CFAB, Division Investments, and you can go to a bank, but you have to put up a collateral or your house or kids or somebody to buy a permit that way. Banks can't hold.
We're going to be dealing with human trafficking. I hope you're not in this session. I hope that was a facetious comment because I don't want to. Please, go ahead.
So we support this. As far as the young folks, Sea Grant is a great program to educate folks in getting into this fishery, because it is a big burden, and you have to know. I didn't have a plan when I started fishing. I just fished, and that was a plan. Go fishing. But now you have to have a plan, a business plan, and Sea Grant's been doing a good job of educating young folks how to pay these loans back. Bristol Bay has set a program out there, too, to talk to young folks about what it takes and have some backup plan. I was really surprised that a lot of the young fishermen, that the young fishermen's son had degrees already before they even just thought about being into fishing. So there's a good opportunity, I think, to raise this a little bit to the times and let the folks that qualify for these loans be able to take advantage of it, the Alaska residents, and that's where we like to have these permits at. And as far as grain and the fleet, I'm probably getting a little gray too, but I have one fella that's 79 years old and one's at 77 still going. And how that happens is that the boats are a lot better than they used to be. You have flush decks. A lot of guys are taking deck hands. So it's a lot different than it was in the 60s when you really, really had to work as Representative Thomas knows that we didn't probably have fathom meters or radios back then, but it's a business now, and you have to look at it as a business when you go to after these loans, and of course you got to qualify. And a lot of people, like I just got my son into the fishery, but to get a permit is a whole different thing. I think a copper river permit just sold for $185,000. And the reason that's that high is its availability, back-to-back two good seasons, and the price. So it's driven, it depends on availability of permits, how many permits are available, and how the seasons are going, how the price is, that kind of dictates this price. And it can go up and then go down just as quickly on a bad season. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. King. Representative Jewell.
Thank you. I've heard attracting a younger generation into this fishery. What's young? Is that somebody that's 40, 30? I'm just trying to picture that. Certainly I wouldn't qualify if we were to have that.
What was the demographic of the young people? Maybe that might be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jill's question, the demographic was the 50 or so people that came down, most of them in their 20s.
Mr. Chairman, I have probably, just from my experience in the Copper River, I think there's probably from 20 to 30 years of age, there's probably about 50 guys in that fishery now getting in. I think my son's 35, and he did everything prior to that, tendering, all kinds of different jobs to get at the point he's at now. I gave him my other boat, so. And so he's working his way. A lot of these permits, too, that people out west would give to their families, a lot of these permits don't go anywhere. They get passed on to their son or daughter or some other family member, so they never get sold. And other people have their own little buying power that they can do this with, but this opportunity is only, there's only three places you can go, so this is just another opportunity to get Alaskans into the fishery.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you, Mr. McCune. Is there anybody else from the public or from anybody wishing to testify on this bill? Here in Juneau, off net. We'll go ahead and close the public testimony. We want to wait for the updated fiscal note, so we have Fritz Johnson from Dillingham. Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson. Okay. Is he generally supportive, Lisa? Okay. We'll go ahead and close the public testimony. If he does show up in the afternoon, we'll take his testimony. We don't have the updated fiscal note. We'll wait till this afternoon. Hopefully, Mr. Michelle, they say they can get to us by then. And that should be a very quick process. I think there's support to move this out from my reading. So we will set this aside until the afternoon. And You want to stay in place?
Sure.
Do another bill? It's your,
see if we can filibuster this one, too.
Mr. Chairman, once again, for the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 37. Just for purposes of introducing House Bill 196, what this bill would like to accomplish is to take the two bulk fuel loan programs that exist in the state and essentially house them in one location. The bill right now it addresses the fact that the bulk fuel revolving loan fund program exists in Alaska Energy Authority, and the bulk fuel bridge program exists in the department and the division of Community Regional Affairs. After discussion with Alaska Energy Authority last year, and also on the heels of the recommendation from the governor's report on energy that was required by then Senate Bill 220 back in the 2010 legislative session, we've come forth with this bill, House Bill 196, to take the two loan programs and for convenience purposes as well as ease of administration to put them in the one division of Community Regional Affairs, and to make the program more accessible, and also remove the fact that applicants have to apply once for the bulk fuel revolving loan fund. If they're turned down, they then turn to the bridge loan program, or they have to apply a second time. We'd like to get rid of that so that we just have one application. It makes the whole program a lot easier. We do have some issues with the fiscal note, just to be real quick about things that I think the department will need to speak to. And with that,
why don't we have Ms. Ayers join you again, and first we'll go through a formality. The bill is unchanged at this point, is my observation. We'll just adopt the bill that Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 196-27-LS0529-B before the committee.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill, this then will be the finance vehicle. Ms. Ayers.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask if Director Scott Ruby with the Division of Community and Regional Affairs is online.
He is online. At least he's signed up. Mr. Ruby, are you online?
Yes, I am.
You're talking to her, not me, right?
Yes, Chairman, I am online.
Okay. All right. Mr. Ruby, I'm going to let Ms. Ayers ask you to direct your testimony. Let you go ahead, Ms. Ayers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the Division of Community and Regional Affairs will be the agency of record with regard to the consolidated loan fund, so they'll do all of the underwriting and work directly with the borrowers. I'm here as the representative for the Division of Economic Development, which will provide loan servicing. And so I think it's appropriate for Director Ruby to talk to the operational aspects of working directly with the borrowers.
Okay, go ahead and feel free to interject at any time, Representative Edgman. Is that there's some disparity of on the fiscal. Please, Mr. Ruby.
Well, what the fiscal notes show, and I believe the disparity that Representative Edgman is referring to, is under the consolidated program, the fiscal note shows that it will cost more to administer than it does currently as it's dispersed into three different programs. Right now, the fiscal notes show it a total cost of $216.6 for administration, and in FY14, the first full year of administration, after the transition year, the cost would be $290.8. Part of that issue is currently the Alaska Energy Authority services a large number of loans, and the loans that they administer now currently is only a small portion of one person's salary, or spread out over several people that process that. And their estimate in their fiscal note is 53.6 that it costs for them to do servicing and accounting of their loans. Currently within DCRA for the Boat Fuel Bridge Loan Program, because we have a relatively small number of loans, we have just assigned that task to an existing staff person, and there is no charge for his cost or personnel cost to the program. When we consolidate the two programs, there would be a large jump for us to administer from 12 to approximately 70 loans, and we would not be able to absorb that within our existing framework. And so we are, our fiscal note shows that we are asking one person for one new PCN and the payroll to do that, or personnel costs to cover that. All other costs there are basically the same as what the existing program is. And then the third part of this is we currently have an RSA with the Division of Economic Development to provide the loan accounting and the invoicing of the bills. We do that through an RSA, an unbudgeted RSA. And under the new program, again, because we would be jumping from a small number to a large number of loans, their fiscal note, they've requested that they can't absorb that with the existing staff, so they would need a new PCN for that and a person assigned to that. And so that there's a personnel costs and their fiscal note are associated with that new position. When you're looking at the fiscal notes, the DED fiscal note is all of that cost is interagency receipts, and that is included in that total cost within DCRA's fiscal note.
Okay, just we'll end up holding this bill as well because we're not going to be in session today. This won't be read across till Wednesday anyway. We won't slow down the process, but there are some fiscal notes. Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have questions if we're consolidating and streamlining a program, why you would need additional funding that's different than is currently being requested.
Mr. Ruby, or Representative Edgman, why don't you respond with your thoughts, and then that might prompt a response from Mr. Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the same question. As well, knowing that the Alaska Energy Authority essentially has a half-time person to deal with the majority of these loans that be transferred to the Division of Community Regional Affairs. The fiscal note that I'm most recently aware of, and again, we've had some confusion with these fiscal notes, calls for DCRA to receive local government specialists at a range 17, as well as the Division of Economic Development to get an accounting tech 2 that actually service the loan, when by consolidating these two loan programs in one division, right now the Division of Community Regional Affairs contracts with a third party to do all the technical services, to do the credit worthiness checks, to do the counseling with these small communities. And these are communities that are smaller than 2,000 population, so we're talking the smaller communities across Alaska. So my question, Representative Fairclough, is your question as well.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Mr. Ruby, are we using technology to help assist us in managing some of these grant applications? In other words, are we doing online grant applications so that the review is shorter on the process and that people are responsible for what they're putting down on the applications?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, no, we make the available, people can download the application online. Typically, we are getting them faxed in to us. A lot of the villages, especially for the bridge loan program, they almost become emergency-type loans. I mean, currently we have two loan applications that are in where the villages contacted us because they had less than 7 days' worth of fuel left, and they needed to secure the loan. And so they had to go through the process of both applying, filling out the application, and submitting it to AEA for a rejection, which is a statutory requirement, and then completing that. The contractor that we have hired, that Representative Edgman referenced, is instrumental in working with communities that have that are high credit risk, that have low capacity to manage these, to make sure that they get the application in. Once the application has been submitted and approved, that contractor then works with them to set appropriate rates, make collections, so that these loans can be repaid.
Mr. Chairman, I just put on the record that, like Representative Edgman, I understand the department's need when they're tasked with additional responsibilities to need additional funds, but this is a pretty big difference between how AEA is managing versus how community and regional affairs might manage. So I question the fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a quick question, then, Representative Guerra. Aren't these like the same clients, same people borrowing the same amount of money, or not the same amount of money, but the same people coming back each year? I mean, you should know them by heart, you know exactly who they are. So I have a problem with the confusion of the PCN Act, too, also. It's just a comment, and somebody can get back. It sounds like they're the same people we've been helping for years on the revolving loan program.
Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up, and that was my question on whether we had IT involved, because if you input the data hard line, it can populate back into any future loan application so that you don't have to redo everything every time you do something. So if you're using technology and we have software, which I know costs money, it seems to me that we could streamline the process more. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. This is like the worst example of streamlining I've ever seen in my life. Maybe we should just take everything and move it over to AEA because they're doing it more efficiently. But at a minimum, it seems that DCED should work with AEA and just say, we'll transfer the halftime position over to DCED, and it's a net zero cost. But I was hoping with streamlining that actually there would be economies of scale and you would need even less personnel. But I'm at a loss to understand how you need more personnel at a cost that is over $300,000 over the long term annually. That's the kind of money that most of us were fighting for at this table to make people's lives better during the budget process. And I can't understand it at all. At a minimum, could you work with AEA and just say, look, we're just transferring the halftime position over? That seems to be all that's needed, but at a maximum, I'd like to see personnel saved.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I think the challenge has been that we have we're going from one operating unit to two operating units. We could certainly attempt on our part to service the loans with a permanent part-time position. The challenge, I think, for both DCRA and DED is that we don't have 100% cost savings from the AEA side, and it's totally understandable. They've allocated a half-time position to the aspect of the loan funds that they've been doing. We've also been processing the bulk bridge loans through an RSA already. And the projection to go from 12 accounts to 70 accounts on our part, understanding the time sensitivity of these kinds of loans. There are times when literally barges are waiting to sail, waiting to know whether or not someone's going to be buying fuel that's going to be loaded on board. There's time sensitivity. It happens to align very specifically with our core population of borrowers in commercial fishing, the time sensitivity of these loans. Fishermen are coming in at the same time. We do project the need to have additional staffing in order to be responsive to both populations.
Just one follow-up. This is coming back tomorrow, maybe, Mr. Chair? Is that? I'm happy to pass it out today and just zero out the fiscal notes. But it's coming. Well, what is the intention of the chair?
I don't know what he's going to do. I think it was his.
He's holding it today.
Maybe we'll see this afternoon again.
I guess this is half facetious, but can you call AEA and see if we transferred everything over to AEA, if they'd be able to do it at no additional cost?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Through the chair, to respond to Representative Garrett's question about why don't we just, you know, put the whole ball of wax in AA as opposed to Division of Community Regional Affairs, when this idea first came forward, that was the whole notion, that we were just going to consolidate everything in Alaska Energy Authority. But after some discussion, it was felt that, the comments of irony that you just meant, you said a moment ago, that we decided collectively with the agency folks to put it in the Community Regional Affairs so that they could take advantage of the seven offices, these local government specialists that they have around the state, to work with Rural Alaska Fuels, their third-party contractor, to achieve those economies of scale, improve upon the services people, a small community comes in, does one application that's simplified. If they don't meet the first loan guidelines, they bounce the second loan, the bridge, the emergency loan, and it's just a lot quicker, simpler, faster, better government service, and all of the above. So this is my opportunity, as it is with you as committee members, to get to hear a sort of a for argument why we need to have full-time specialists when fuel delivery in rural Alaska occurs once or twice a year. You know, it's when the barges sail. I've never gotten a clear picture why we need these extra personnel. That was not my intent, to bring a bill forward that have extra positions. We have not gotten a clear response back. I'm hearing things now that I would have liked to have heard before.
I understand your frustration.
Okay, Representative Costello, then Wilson.
Thank you. I think my questions are in the vein of the previous one, but my thought process was we talk oftentimes about shifting programs between departments and divisions and things like that. And with our recent focus on missions, I was curious to hear a response on, why the choice was made to go to DCRA. It's I think, the only division in state government that has a constitutionally derived mandate. It's Section 10 or Article 10, Section 14 of the Constitution that asked the division to actually report what's going on in communities and provide that information. And then you look at AEA's mission, which is to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. And so I'm just curious, again, why the focus wasn't just simply to put everything in AEA. Or even perhaps community economic development, if you have the RSA with them anyway. I'm not sure this is the most efficient way to go about it, and I was wondering if you could respond to the decision to move it out of ADA.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Costello, maybe that would be a great discussion to have with Alaska.
Your staff is really champing at the bit to say something. as long as he's not bucking the protocol in your office.
No, and let me just take a first stab at that. One of the reasons that we decided that we better go over to DCR as opposed to AA is that AA is taking on more responsibilities by the day, including a project called Susitna. And we felt that in order to work with these smaller communities to help get them situated better, that the capabilities of DCR was much better suited to that, including these offices that they have scattered around rural Alaska, Nome, Kotzebue, Dillingham, all up and down the coast, if you will. So it was just basically that was the premise behind choosing DCRA over AEA.
Through the chair, in reading the bill packet, it seemed like communities are having to go through an application process once and then start again from scratch. And the Commissioner of Commerce is a board member of ADA, which is the board for AEA. And so I was curious if this problem had ever been brought to the level of the board and was attempted to be solved at that point, because as Representative Fairclough mentioned, it seems to me that what we're trying to solve here is several issues. One is simply a communication or an integration issue.
Representative Costello, through the chair, as Representative Edgman mentioned, there was consideration about consolidating the programs with AEA, but in looking at some of those issues and determining that the program could be consolidated in the Department of Commerce, I believe those discussions were held. As far as efficiencies, operational efficiencies about the borrowers, each time a loan is made, there are certain presentations of documents and the definitely processing of the capability to pay on the loan. Again, maybe Mr. Ruby might want to speak to the underwriting process that DCRA envisions, but I know from a loan servicing standpoint, again, these are often very time critical. They require a great deal of focus and responsiveness at a crucial time when fuel sales, barge sailings, and other assurances need to be made in a timely manner to make sure that those things all move forward apace and we don't hold up the process. Thank you.
Okay, one more question, then we'll take public testimony and set the bill aside. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I have this clear because it sounds like that you already have 12, and so 12 comes out of the 70, so we're only talking 58 increased. And these 58 that we're talking about are basically the same communities every year. Is that true?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, essentially that is correct, although typically, there are loans that take place several times a year. Some communities may only borrow once a year, but many borrow twice a year.
But they're the same communities?
Correct.
Okay, and so if I'm understanding correctly, part of the problem is the communities are not getting a hold of these loans soon enough. They're basically dipping the tank and finding out it's empty and not maybe being as proactive. I know when I do that in our community, they charge us extra when we let that happen. So it sounds more like maybe some educational factors helping these areas to maybe more quickly get those loans is where the issue is versus another person into it. I mean, I guess it's what Representative Faircloth was saying. We're filling out the same paperwork year after year. If we're making them go through this huge process, knowing who we're working with, it's unfair to the communities. But at the same time, the communities maybe need to know there's certain deadlines. Otherwise, it's going to cost more, you know, toward the community versus being proactive. That's just what I'm hearing, that it seems like there's two issues going on here. Yes, we're increasing the load, but once you go through the process the first time, every year it's the same communities. It's just maybe timeliness on their part, putting the department into kind of a crisis management versus handling them on a regular basis.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I can speak to the fact that in the consolidation of the two loan programs, that the department hopes that there will be some synergies and that there will be a possibility. We know that there are circumstances where borrowers have been under consideration at AEA while a credit decision was being made. They were under consideration for being transferred over to the bulk fuel bridge loan, and that those kinds of transfers create some of that timeliness issues. I think in working with the borrowers on a regular basis that DCRA can achieve some efficiencies, and I would think Mr. Ruby would be the person to speak to that.
Thank you.
I can address that. The department has been trying to be very proactive in getting communities to apply for loans. One of the things that we have undertaken over the last several years is called what we have called Fuel Watch, where we have contacted every buyer of fuel in rural Alaska, bulk jar of fuel that has to do periodic payments, to see what the status of their payments are. And that has really addressed in some, the handful of communities. Typically, there's 8 to 10 communities a year that, due to staff turnover or other issues, end up coming in extremely late and trying to get a loan. Sometimes it's a negotiation ploy with the different fuel companies to try and get a lower rate or are trying to time out. they're getting a loan with when the fuel can be delivered. You know, the loans that we have, Juanetta referred to as, although currently we have, you know, a dozen borrowers, we have over 49 loans with those because they many of those are air fuel, where we have to fly in fuel, and so each disbursement or each time they refill their tanks periodically through the winter ends up coming up being another loan. Now, they have one approval for that, but there still needs to be the arrangement for the fuel to be delivered. We have to get the invoices, process the invoices, and the payments made, and then set up a repayment schedule. So one borrower may have eight different repayment schedules that they are on eight deliveries that they're processing. And a lot of the staff time is addressed in working with the communities on their cash flow basis, negotiating whether the state revenue sharing gets paid towards that, what is the timing for the state revenue sharing. And obviously, our contractor also works with that. But that is really kind of what the role, most of the work that the position within DCED does is not application-oriented. It is more so making sure that the community has the cash flow and the ability and the procedures in place to repay the loan so that they don't default.
Representative Edgerton.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, a couple of things. One, there's some larger issues surrounding this whole subject, and one is that the turnover in these smart communities with administrators, with city personnel, when you look at the application of the 58 of the 70 that we were talking about, every year that you do an application, you have to provide detailed financial statements you can't use payroll tax returns or check registers or bank statements. You've got to have detailed financial statements that go along with every application, whether it's the revolving loan fund or the bridge fund itself. You know, we're also in an era where oil prices are a lot higher, so cash flow issues with these smaller communities on top of having turnover in the city offices or the village office or whoever is the governing entity in the village really make for some pretty challenging circumstances that a lot of us have been doing our best to help these communities get past. And the communities themselves very much want not to have to come back to the agency to get go through this whole process. So it's there's some bigger issues involved with this as well. And, the same communities for sure, but different personnel at these communities is going to make a big difference.
Okay, thank you. We got two that want to testify, and then we'll set the bill aside. Bill Conrad, are you online?
I am.
Hello. Name and affiliation?
This is Dale Conrad. I'm the CEO of Rural Alaska Fuel Services.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm here to testify strongly in favor of 196 for the first 6 years of the bridge loan program. Rural Alaska Fuel Services was the contractor who managed that program. And over that period, there were some significant changes that took place. But initially, the program was set up as a grant, and the loan funds were actually given to me with the provision that any unpaid or any remaining funds would return to the state if the state ever ended the program. And so we managed all of the bridge loan loans from soup to nuts, starting with getting the application. Then we'd review it. We would get approval from DCRA after we made a recommendation to approve that loan. And at that point, I would cut the check to the fuel vendor. We would do the invoicing monthly. We'd do the collections. We'd go out and visit with the communities and work with them on pricing and collection issues. And so I have a pretty good understanding of the entire process that's required. About 2 or 2.5 years ago, the program was changed to be a loan program instead of a grant program, and the state became much more involved with the processing of the paperwork. But the fact is, I don't understand the need for more than half a person to do the actual administration of the program. The bulk of my work with those financially distressed communities was in actually working with them to establish budgets, to establish pricing, to go out and meet with the communities, to justify to the community why the prices had to be where they were. So I think, you know, there's a real value to combining these programs, to eliminating the administrative duplication, both on the part of the state and the part of the borrowing community. And so that's, I think, critical. I think it's important that it be under DCRA because, frankly, the AEA program acts like a bank, which is appropriate, but DCRA's focus is on sustainable communities. And so for those communities that become financially distressed, it's important to go beyond just, I have to collect the money. And the local government specialists are familiar with the folks out in the communities. They know how to deal with them. They know what their issues are. And their focus is on creating those sustainable communities as well. And that's why overall I think that the program makes a lot more sense to be in DCRA than over in AEA. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I see no questions. Thank you. Mira Kohler, are you there?
Thank you. My name is Mira Kohler, and I am the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Co-op, and I am also calling to testify in favor of HB 196. As you heard from Dale Conrad a few minutes ago, RAFT was one of the original parties involved in the bulk fuel bridge loan program. That program was actually enacted late one year, and it was AVEC actually that started that program and got it in place, and then subcontracted with RAFT to do the actual administration of the program after we got it running. Another thing that pertains to this is a few years ago, I, as a member of the Alaska Village Council President's CEO group, I chaired a subcommittee on rural fuel issues. And what we looked at, what we found was that the creditworthiness of the communities was the biggest barrier to them receiving timely fuel deliveries and getting better pricing on the fuel deliveries. And part of that was because of the process that has to be undergone to get a bulk fuel loan through the conventional loan program. We found it to be really a rather daunting process because every year you have to go through the process of putting together all the elements to apply for a loan. And really, it's a little bit like rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. It seems much more logical to have both the loans administered by the same agency. I think that DCRA would be a better entity in the long term because, as was pointed out, ADA AEA is really, it's a banking institution. It doesn't have the same relationship with the villages. DCRA, on the other hand, has the Rural Utility Business Assistance Program, and through that element, they actually have inroads into the villages and connections there that I think would help make these villages more sustainable financially if they were able to manage the program. As it stands, you know, we do perceive that there is some gaming that goes on between the two programs, and it really would be important, I think, to bring an end to that. So I think that this bill is a move in the right direction. Obviously, there are some rough edges that will need to be ironed out, but I think that could be gotten to in a fairly simple process through the regulatory process. So I do support the bill and hope that you will move it onward to the House floor so that it can move over and get enacted this year.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
And with that, I conclude my testimony.
Thank you. I see no questions. We're going to set this mill aside. Bring it up this afternoon. Oh, anybody in the audience want to testify? Seeing none, nobody else online. So we close public testimony. We'll set this aside, waiting for the fiscal note, and bring it up this afternoon. And we'll take a brief at ease.
Let's come back to order. We'll take up House Bill 9 now. Very abbreviated schedule. Invite the one of the sponsors back up again, or staff, whichever you prefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your records, I'm Mike Hawker, District 32.
And Tom Wright, staff to the Speaker, who should be here shortly.
And just while we're waiting, I'll just say there are proposed amendments. It's our desire to make sure the public is aware of these. Turn those into the clerk to Mr. Michelle and my staff, and then he'll give them to the clerks, and we will electronically post them so the public knows what potential amendments are out there. And Representative Gary, you have some that are in the process. Give those to Mr. Michelle as soon as they're done, and we'll post those as well. But it's the intent of the committee to post all proposed amendments in the public domain so that they're available for folks to peruse those. I know one of them is a fairly long and substantive one, and as well as any analysis that accompanies the amendment. So with that stated, I know it probably is unfair to ask you to talk in detail about your amendments, but just go ahead and once you use this time we have, 10 minutes, as best you see fit to educate the committee and the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll do this very expeditiously. The sponsors are bringing forward two amendments to House Bill 9 at this time. One amendment deals with confidentiality provisions of state agencies, and the other amendment is a very substantial amendment that deals with regulatory authority under the Regulatory Commission of Alaska for contract carrier pipelines. If you'd like a very brief explanation, I would ask Mr. Wright, Speaker, or staff to the Speaker, to explain the confidentiality amendment briefly, and I would ask my that you allow my staff, Ms. Rena Delbridge, to explain the RCA amendment.
Sure. Go ahead, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tom Wright, staff to Speaker Chenault. The amendment number 2, which you'll be dealing with at a later time, was requested by the Department of Law and was worked primarily between the Department of Law and AGDC to ensure that any information the state may have can be considered confidential, but if AGDC would like that information, they would have to get the consent of the third party involved in order to have access to that information.
It will be our desire to, when we those amendments do come forward, to have Department of Law here, because they were integral in the development.
And they are here, Mr. Chairman, and there will be this afternoon. Okay.
And that's the Cliff Notes version. But with that understanding, we'll go to Ms. Delbridge. Excuse me.
Ms. Delbridge, staff to Representative Hawker. The other amendment that the sponsors want to bring is as Representative Hawker said, rather lengthy. What this amendment does is replaces three sections that are now in House Bill 9 that essentially exempt the line from any regulatory oversight, and replaces those sections with a new chapter to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska statutes, very clearly stating how this line would in fact fall under the RCA's framework for regulating an in-state natural gas pipeline that's explicitly authorized to operate as a contract carrier. Currently, there is no regulation in place for a contract carrier pipeline. This amendment would create that framework of regulation. It requires regulation on the front end through approval of contracts as just and reasonable, providing that they were entered into at arm's length, and requires a special limited scope certificate of public convenience and necessity for this special pipeline.
Representative Aaron, can you, if you wish, you would summarize what you will, just for the public's education, what you're going to try to do in an amendment?
Sure.
Undrafted.
Sure. We have a series of them, but the one that's on the table is aimed at this, that this project only go forward if we determine that it's the most efficient project that will lead to the lowest prices for Alaska consumers. We want the ANGDA to look at other projects first, a pipeline from Cook Inlet up to Fairbanks, possibly subsidizing a contract that's already in the works to truck gas down to Fairbanks, and to look at whether or not there's enough gas in Cook Inlet to buy us more time to try and put together a deal on a big pipeline, because that is, I think, the one that produces the lowest price gas, the most revenue for the state, and really is the one that leads to a future for the state that is much brighter than any of the other proposals out there. So that's what that amendment does, that those things be analyzed before we move ahead with this project. One other I can say pretty quickly is I think the RCA framework for setting prices for consumers, tariffs for consumers, I think that framework should stay as it is until somebody convinces me that it should be changed because it's a process that's aimed at protecting consumer prices.
We will invite you to post your amendments, but we won't have the editorials on the other amendments. That was just a brief thing for now and during debate. Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I know you're speaking to amendments that are before the committee right now. Just to inform the committee that I am working on an amendment that hasn't been completed yet, but it has to do with a tax cap issue up in the North Slope and a couple of boroughs, but we're not there on language yet. So.
Okay. It'll go the same process, and maybe they'll be before us before we're hoping that if you do have them ready, or when you do, we want to post them for just the broadest public awareness and participation. So we will, we're 0 for 3 in getting things moved out today, but we're pretty close to having two of them. But I think we had a pretty good discourse. We got to talk about commercial fishing and sport fishing, so and baseball and metaphors. And I didn't say anything too stupid, but I'll wait till I read. But that, what's that? Oh, and we have a number of people that are online on House Bill 9. We had folks from the Attorney General's office, the Gas Line Development Corporation, three of those. We had some citizens from the Interior and the Highway System. They've all, I've got them noted that they posted and want to testify. It's our intent, I'll break this to you guys, that we're going to look at some evening testimony, and we have the contacts for everybody that's written in, I hope, and we'll personally contact you, and we will put out, in addition to the committee announcement, we'll also put out a press notice about given that it's happening so quickly. We're shooting for Wednesday and Thursday night testimony. Hopefully that'll be the most convenient time for the general public. I know that it might not be for a lot of these state-paid employees. That might be different, but our concern is about the public participation, and I think they'll show up. The bureaucrats and the folks will show up anyway. My apologies to the folks that came out to their LIOs in Glen Allen and Fairbanks that we didn't get the public testimony, but it's our intent to have several opportunities before we're done here at times in the evening that would be convenient for working Alaskans such as yourself. With that, we will stand in adjournment until our next posted meeting at 1:30.
Thank you.